Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this lecture in the Senate Department's occasional lecture series. Shortly after the great bushfires in Canberra, in 2003 there was an article in the Canberra Times which said that economic growth in Canberra would be 2 or 3% higher because of all the activity involved in replacing all the houses that were burned down. And as we all know, economic growth is a good thing. I sent an email to Senator Bob Brown saying, there you go, you not only can stimulate economic growth by chopping trees down, you've just got to burn the darn things. I also decided at that stage that economics was the mad science, not the dismal science. However, notwithstanding that, we have today invited a distinguished economist to address us, who I'm told is one of Australia's rational distinguished economists. And on that basis, we've invited him to address us today. Please welcome him to the podium.
I can assure you, 99% of economists think I'm irrational. Okay, thank you all for being here, and I hope that you'll find it interesting, if not agreeing with me. Figures that I've got a text. There's figures in it which are in the text, and obviously I'm not going to have to read out the figures and explain all the graphs, and I'll just have to skate over that. I've only got about three quarters an hour to 55 minutes to allow for questions, so I'll have to obviously summarise stuff. You'll know when I do that because the flow will get disjointed and wrecked. But anyway, we'll have to do that. Basically, what I have been asked to do today is update my 2001 Alfred Deakin Federation lecture, which was entitled The Australian Federation, 2001, Political Structures and Economic Policy. The basic message, when I'm going to talk today, is go on to that, is that Australia, unless Australia adopts a middle course between the highly successful corporate estate model of development and the extreme neoliberal model that Australia has selected as its development framework, then Australia's internal stability and national security could well be severely degraded over the next two decades. In short, my message is that Australia will have to relearn and reapply strategies and instruments to govern the market. This will involve some restoration of the practices and institutions that were swept away in the name of microeconomic reform over the last two decades. Australia will never be able to match the efficiency of the informal governance structures of corporate estates. For Australia, the leadership will have to be provided by its governance institutions in general, and Parliament in particular. To paraphrase the recent book by Stephen Margolin, which he titled The Dismal Science, How Thinking Like an Economist Undermines Community, my lecture is all about the Australian neoliberal model, how thinking like an economist will degrade economic performance, social stability and national sovereignty. Australia has a limited understanding of history. The defeat of communism was not the defeat for models aimed at governing the market. It was the defeat of one particular model by a far more efficient model for governing the market. In my 2001 Alfred Deakin lecture, I set out to explain why Australia in the 1980s had adopted the extreme neoliberal or economic rationalist model as its development framework, and some likely consequences. Put simply, I argued the reason was the relatively weak state of Australia's parliamentary institutions as representative democracy, coupled with strong executive and strong party discipline. This is not to say, of course, that the Australian system does not produce good outcomes for many decisions. The problem is that for some key strategic decisions, the tendency is to select simple, easy-to-market solutions for economic and social problems that reflect the capacity, interests, and vision of the leadership group, which will include those established interests that have an affinity with political leadership. More complex solutions that require the input of the broader political community and the design of new governance structures that may lie beyond the control of strong, established interests, including bureaucratic interests, tend to be eliminated at an early stage. In my 2001, I said the consequences of this were going to be increasing wealth inequalities and income inequalities, no fundamental solution to our narrow-based economy and high current account deficit and foreign debt, financial instability from the capacity of the financial sector to expand debt to whatever level that was in its interest, and a vulnerability to negative economic shocks, which of course now include the shock of a carbon price. What I'm going to do today, you can go and read the 2001 lecture which focused on the why. Today I'm going to elaborate on the consequences in more detail. But first we have to go through and just look at what we mean by a corporate estate model, because it's very central to the issue. The neoliberal approach focuses on market conduct and structures on the assumption that if market conduct and structure is appropriate, then optimal outcomes will be achieved. Whatever outcomes are achieved by market forces will, in the main, are defined as optimal. Corporate estates tend to approach development from the reverse direction. Objectives are specified in terms of social, political, security, export and industry output and cost targets. The means are then designed to mobilise whatever is necessary to achieve the defined objectives in the minimum time, subject to global resource constraints and global, if not local, market forces. The strategies of corporate estates to achieve objectives involve reducing the risk to the institutions, both governance and commercial, charged with the responsibility of ensuring the objectives are achieved. They do this by building large-scale enterprises to dominate markets and supply chains, reaping maximum economies of scale and scope, and reducing market risk to a minimum, ensuring that all necessary resources in terms of finance, skills and technology are available for the task, ensuring that any other domestic or foreign organisation cannot impede the performance of the chosen organisations for the task, and tending to rely on regulation rather than the price mechanism. The early is one of the early corporate estates, of course, that was most successful at these sort of strategies was Germany in the 30s, which grew by over 12% between 33 and 37 and cut unemployment from a third to back to full employment. The debate is over whether it could have been done differently, but the fact it was done this way and seemed to succeed changed history. The North Asian economies took note of the German strategies and applied them post-war with astonishing results. To take one example, the case of South Korea is miraculous. In 1961, South Korea had an annual income of $82 per person, or less than half that of Guyana at the time. Today is one of the wealthiest countries in the world. It took the United Kingdom 2 centuries and the United States 1.5 centuries to achieve the same results. More importantly, Korea, Taiwan and Singapore continue to maintain per capita GDP growth rates well beyond the level achieved by other countries with similar high levels of per capita income. In this category, in this context, we can continue 3 types of corporate estates. The social market model of Western Europe, where democratic institutions, where policy institutions rely on codified statute and regulations, with some reliance on non-parliamentary governance bodies representing stakeholder interests. The corporate estate model of Singapore, Korea, Japan, and Taiwan, which may or may not have effective democratic institutions, but where governance is semi-non-transparent, relying on networks between governments, bureaucracy and businesses with decisions made in the interests of the collective, irrespective of codified statutes and regulations. The penalties for non-compliance are exclusion from social networks and business supply chains, with severe consequences for social standing and material advancement. 3, the extreme authoritarian models of Germany, Italy in the 30s and Russia and China today, where along with social and commercial exclusion, violence, that is loss of property, liberty and the extreme cases life, is a penalty for non-compliance. The extreme authoritarian model has an impenetrable informal governance structure. The Germans showed in the 1930s, in the context of modern communications, that the arrest of an individual for economic treason, when it was clearly understood that the real crime was the import of product instead of using the favoured domestic supplier, was a very effective form of industry policy, which did away with the need for costly tariffs, subsidies and other financial inducements. It is in this context, interesting to note that the criteria applied in determining what foreign enterprises can and cannot do currently in China is expressed in terms of largely undefined parameters based on the concept of national economic security. Many countries, of course, aspire to the status of corporate estates. Few, however, have the capacity to reach the desired levels of performance. On this criteria, the classification of Russia as a corporate estate is somewhat problematic. Of high importance to Australia, which I'll come to it back in the end of my talk, to Australia's national interest is how China will evolve. Neoliberals tend to assume it will evolve into a market-based economy. China is not going to be transformed into a neoliberal market economy. Instead, it may well transform itself into perhaps the most efficient corporate estate model of all time, with, over the next 2 to 3 decades, one, a large number of state-owned or indirectly controlled enterprises becoming the largest companies in the world, dominating the control of capacity in many industries. Two, a Communist Party which will grow rapidly and in influence on the basis of generating individual material advancement that will also provide an informal governance framework that will simply be impenetrable. No matter what the codified statutes, China will have the machinery of governments capable of doing the opposite on non-transparent demand. In this context, who controls the enterprises is largely irrelevant. The Chinese see large-scale foreign investment in China mainly as a short-term strategy to introduce new technologies, management expertise and new skills generation, and to construct distribution systems to the world in the shortest possible time. It is likely, as their enterprises are built up to world competitiveness, the assets of foreign enterprises that directly compete with and are of no strategic value if left independent to a mandated Chinese enterprise will be taken over by a combination of intimidation, as per Russian approach to BP and Shell assets in oil and gas recently, financial incentives and frustration, of which the recent creation of the Communist Party control of trade union cells in foreign enterprises will be a useful tool. At worst, foreign enterprises exiting China may find that they will lose a significant portion of non-Chinese assets and intellectual property, and in the extreme, the entire enterprise. The only major uncertainty about China is to the extent to which extreme nationalism will become a hallmark of these extreme relations, similar to what occurred in Germany in the late 1930s. The recent signs in this regard are not encouraging. There are signs that strong taking root amongst the young, with the state having the capacity, like Germany, to manufacture outpourings of mass nationalism triggered by suitable incidents. The optimists assume that massive environmental problems and widening inequalities will trigger a move, at worst, towards the social market model. The pessimists contend the threats to the legitimacy of the elite in the context of severe resource and environmental constraints will result in a sustained administration of the drug of extreme nationalism and the rectification of past injustices at the hands of the West. It is beginning to realise that this is the future. 1990 wasn't the end of history, and we are now returning to history. To quote Robert Kagan in his just published book, The Return of History and the End of Dreams, he says, "If East Asia today resembles late 19th and early 20th century Europe, a comparatively minor incident could infuriate the Chinese and lead them to choose war despite their reluctance. It would be comforting to imagine that this will all dissipate as China grows richer and more confident. But history suggests that as China grows more confident, it will grow less, if not more, tolerant of obstacles in its path. The Chinese themselves have few illusions on this score. They believe this great strategic rivalry will only, quote, increase with the ascension of Chinese power." But we don't have to get into this sort of very pessimistic outlook. All we need to assume, as is the case here, that China behaves no worse than the United States as a global power, or no worse than the Western European powers behaved towards China in the 19th century, to arrive at the conclusion that a difficult period for Australia lies ahead. I'll return to that. The immediate inconsistency between my reason for Australia and the corporate estates, of course, is the obvious. The corporate estates have even more politically exclusive and dominated by existing bureaucratic and commercial interests than what is the case for Australia. Yet these states, because of a combination of history, culture, ethnic homogeneity, strength of nationalism, genes, a common view of economic competition as warfare by other means requiring the nation to be on a permanent war footing, or whatever, I don't know, are capable of delivering high-performance, sustainable outcomes on a long-term basis. I do know that emulating their political structures and conduct is no answer for Australia. Based on observed Western European outcomes, the appropriate response to these sorts of corporate estates is not to emulate them in political structures, but to achieve similar outcomes by strengthening the institutions of representative democracy. That is, governments and the institutions of governments are important in contrast to the neoliberal view that governments is relatively unimportant. Now I'm going to turn to the focus for Australia on the neoliberal solutions and then return to the issue of foreign relations. First is monetary policy, domestic monetary policy. In the 2000 lecture, I pointed to the Australian neoliberal privatised monetary policy model, where no intermediate target for credit growth was set, as is the case for the European Union. For Australia, provided CPI inflation is within the desired bounds, then debt accumulation can be at whatever level the market was willing to absorb. For the European Central Bank, inflation in the long run is a monetary phenomenon, and any credit growth on a sustained basis in excess of desired nominal GDP growth will result in undesirable inflation. In Australia, credit growth in excess of desired nominal GDP growth is taken as a sign of a healthy economy. The reverse is the case for the euro system. And I've shown, there's a table in the text which shows that over the last 12 years, the European Bank has achieved its objectives with the ratio of M3 GDP being constant, whereas Australia has grown by 28%. This may not sound much, but as will be outlined below, the consequences for long-run economic and social stability will be very large. Over the years, I have criticised the Australian approach to monetary policy as irresponsible. That is, I've argued with the European Central Bank view, I've agreed with the European Central Bank view, provided inflation is defined as including both established asset prices, that is shares and dwellings, as well as newly produced goods and service prices, the CPI. Therefore, I've argued a sustained credit growth in excess of desired nominal GDP growth will increase the vulnerability of the economy to negative shocks by encouraging borrowing for consumption and driving down household savings ratios. Two, create an increasing portion of households in what I call with serf status by forcing households to pay high debt service or rent payments as a portion of income over an extensive period of their life cycle. Three, lead to house prices and rents putting home ownership beyond the reach of increasing proportions of the population. And four, easy short-term growth from excessive monetary growth, diverting energy and attention from the main game, which is the constant resource mobilisation effort required for long-run sustainable growth, which Australia, in my view, last decade and a half has failed miserably. I've got some figures which basically indicate in terms of current vulnerability of the economy as a result of past accumulated excess monetary growth, showing that over the last 8 years, the increase in household borrowing for non-dwelling investment purposes has risen from 5% to 15% of income. If only a third of this was used to support consumption directly, then a repeat of the 1991 experience of household borrowings for non-dwelling investment turning negative, as could easily be the case right as we sit, as we speak, it would cause household savings ratio increasing by 5 to 7 percentage points, which would plunge the economy into the severest recession since the Depression. The figure which I've got in the text clearly shows the dilemma facing the Reserve Bank of Australia as self-evident and reflective of their comments a couple of days ago. Although inflation is 1.5 percentage points above the 3% upper bound of acceptable outcomes, the RBA can either maintain tight monetary control and risk a severe recession, or abandon tight monetary policy and risk the return of longer-term unsatisfactory inflation, thereby simply postponing the day of reckoning to greater pain down the track. The RBA, in my view, has only itself to blame for this, as it's simply the result of a decade of irresponsible monetary policy. It knew of the European Central Bank approach, but showed no intellectual leadership and simply went along with the short-term political objective of maintaining the financing of the new aspirational society. Indeed, a good case can be made that Australia's low inflation rate over the decades was in spite, not because of the RBA. That is, from the China price effect, the productivity potential of the economy created by the severity of the 1991 recession, the reduction in protection, etc. Its only effective task in this period was to ensure that financial structural disequilibrium did not occur. It failed. Ultimately, Parliament will be held responsible for delegating, without appropriate guidelines, a core governance responsibility to unelected officials. Second, serfdom. But what if we escape the current policy difficulty and interest rates start to come down within a year or so? The current undersupply of housing, a shortage of around 150,000 units by 2010, is increasing rents, and when interest rates come down will trigger a rapid rise in dwelling prices as many try to escape rental crisis status. In other words, the 2003 to 2007 cycle will be repeated, with a further increase in the proportion of households that could be classified as serfs, risking longer-term social stability. Now, to elaborate on the serfs. The origins of serfdom in Russia were based on the need to keep labour fixed in place because of the excess supply of land relative to labour. One tactic that was used to keep labour in place was the propensity of the landlord, the farmer of the day, to willingly lend to peasants all that was needed and more for implements, livestock, fencing, etc. It was another unfortunate linking of rapidly available finance with an emerging aspirational society. Droughts, wars, plagues would force more and more lending until peasants were hopelessly in debt. The debt serfdom facilitated legislated serfdom, with the peasant tied to land with the requirement up to 3 days a week work for the landlord. As other family members could work on the serf's allocated land or in the cash economy, modern serf status will be taken here to arise when households pay over 35% of income in debt service and rent. The recent Australian history of more than doubling of the household debt-to-income ratio since the mid-1990s is well known, and there is little recognition of what this may mean at the micro level. As tables in the text show, it means less households in fully owned status. There was a big fall between 2001 and 2006, and more households paying more than 35% of income in rent and debt service costs. In terms of mortgage households, those households which have a mortgage, the 2008 estimate of the share of households paying more than 35% of income in debt service costs is now 23% due to the interest rate rises since June 2006. It should be kept in mind that from the 2006 census, those households paying more than 35% of income in debt service costs were paying an average debt service cost of just under 50% of income. That is, the standard of a household with no debt would be on average twice that of the average household of serf status, despite both households having the same income. By 2018, on current conservative estimates, such as an increase of the household debt-to-income ratio of 30% from current levels, which is a much slower rate of increase than in the past, and interest rates declining from current levels, it is estimated that at least 22% of all households will be paying more than 35% of income in debt service and rent costs, or a doubling since 1996 levels. This, of course, excludes high debt fully owned households. It may be claimed that use of the concept serf status in the modern context is over the top, as households can eventually escape debt status, and Russian serfdom was intergenerational. I would counter-argue that in fact the intergenerational aspect of serfdom is de facto also emerging in modern times. The movement towards neoliberal solutions in education and households and health means that access to quality services is determined by household circumstances. The greater the number of households in serf status, the more likely the serf status will be passed on to their children from underinvestment in social capital, complemented by increasing resort to reverse mortgages, allowing a lifetime of high debt service costs with little or no inheritance for children. This is consistent with findings from the United States vis-a-vis Sweden. For the United States, the correlation coefficient with the status of parents and children is around 0.5, while for high taxing, equal opportunity, education, health access Sweden, it is 0.2. The irony is the United States is a society that is approaching as rigid an intergenerational class structure as what prevailed in Europe in the 18th and 19th century, which in part forced the migration to the United States. In Australia, the likelihood is that if something radical is not done here, there will be a high degree of intergenerational correlation in serf status. This will leave Australia with an unenviable choice around 2030 of either a severe one-off tax on wealth to emancipate the serfs, in quotes, or suppression of the serf class to maintain social stability. In any case, in 2018, shown by the results on the table, Australia will be a very grumpy place. Economists have discovered that after national per capita income is greater than $20,000 US, happiness is a function of relative, not absolute incomes. The greater the serf class, the greater the inequality of discretionary incomes, and the greater the level of unhappiness. One of the core solutions to arrest the march towards a serf society is to significantly increase housing affordability for first home buyers. In this regard, the case of Germany is important, since German house prices in nominal terms are only a little more than they were a decade ago and have fallen in real terms. In other parts of Europe, house prices have doubled, such as Italy. So although the ECB-type monetary policy has helped, it is a necessary, not a sufficient condition for maintaining high levels of housing affordability. Many other things are required. For Australia, over the same period, the increase in house prices has been a little over 180%. You would think that current German housing market policies would be the top of the agenda for all Australian governments. They don't seem to be. Corporate estate-type housing solutions have been followed in Austria and Germany for decades. These are called social partnerships. These policies aim at coordinating and accommodating conflicting interests between landlords, tenants, financial institutions and government. One core feature is risk shifting from the private sector to the state. And they're all listed there in the text. Basically, it's what we used to have, dedicated government institutions lending for housing, direct support to builders and homeowners for construction, all the things that we used to have before they were swept away to let the market do the trick. The interesting thing, of course, is that rental status in Germany is quite high at 43%, and people seem to be happy with that. This is because if you're in rental status, you get long-term contracts of between 3 and 10 years that can only be terminated from the landlord's perspective on a narrow range of criteria, and define rules for rent increases, CPI, and a bit of augmentation for local area livability increases. So all the things that we used to have before they were swept away is the key to the success of the German housing market policy. But the overarching German objective is to ensure that the supply of houses runs well ahead of demand. In an equal society, increasing housing affordability and equal opportunity for housing affordability can only come from one strategy, namely the rationing of opportunities by rationing of finance and a very target list of incentives. This is how the market was governed to allow Australia to evolve its last major housing crisis after World War II. Each state had different strategies. Victoria rationed credit by the State Savings Bank, while New South Wales, which lost its savings bank during the Depression, focused on public sector housing construction. There were many other niche instruments similar to Germans which were swept away over the last 20 years under the mantra, the market will solve everything. If corporate estates are as good as I am inferring in economic development, then it would be expected they will be well ahead in the provision of quality telecommunications infrastructure for such countries as Australia, which follows neoliberal approaches, where the market structure and conduct is important. This is the case. As of mid-2008, the average download speed in the United States was 2 megabits per second, 61 megabits per second in Japan, 45 megabits per second in South Korea, 18 in Sweden and 17 in France. 80% of households in Japan can connect to a fibre network at a speed of 100 megabits per second, 30 times the average speed of the United States. Australia is 30 to 50% below US levels. Australia has announced a supply-side initiative to improve things, but the past delay in trying to incorporate market forces into the process will mean that, like electricity to Timbuktu, Australia will get there, but only when quality communications is a competitive necessity and no longer a competitive advantage. Also, the image of Australia being a technological laggard is not a good one to attract investment. The same approach in many other economic aspects has and will cost Australia dearly. There's no better example of this than the approach to greenhouse gas abatement policies. The design of greenhouse gas abatement regimes currently being undertaken in Australia is proceeding along strict neoliberal lines. The central cornerstone is that the market is the most efficient platform to engineer the appropriate response. All a government has to do is to set an emissions cap, and the resulting price increases will miraculously allow the emissions objective to be achieved. The miracle of the market, to quote from the recent Green Paper summary, there are two distinct elements of a cap and trade scheme, the cap itself and the ability to trade. The cap achieves the environmental outcome of reducing greenhouse gas pollution. The act of capping emissions creates a carbon price. The ability to trade ensures that emissions are reduced at the lowest possible cost, unquote. The reality is it won't. Let's just take the electricity sector, which of course has a big role to play in emissions reductions. Let's assume that a target is set to reduce total emissions by 20% below 2005 levels, which would be the same as the EU's current 2020 target. This would mean 223 million tonnes reduction from a 2020 business as usual level. Of the 223 million tonnes, a large part of the reduction would need to come from the electricity sector. Around 91 million tonnes would need to come from replacing 11,000 megawatts of coal-fired plant. To do this, the price of carbon would need to, on ours and ASIL Tasman estimates, quickly ramp up to around $55 a tonne, based on the long-run marginal cost of alternative supply, in order to achieve the long-run marginal cost of combined cycle gas turbine plant, which would be needed to replace the black coal, along with the mandated federal renewables target. A corporate estate would immediately include that the Australian market of independent generators, independently bidding for supply, would not be successful even if the $55 price was achieved. The market won't react because to achieve the target, the risk is simply too great for the $50 billion investment in generation, gas development, pipeline, transmission line, etc. to be spent. These risks include existing supplier risk, where the modelling assumes, of course, that once the price reaches the long-run marginal price for a black coal plant, it will go out of the market. Nonsense. The existing owners will go bankrupt, but the plant could easily be picked up at very little value, and then the new owners could sell back into the market with a 20 to 25 tonne of CO2 price advantage. Therefore, to get the necessary price response, you don't need $55 a tonne, you need $80 a tonne. But, of course, you're not going to get that unless the plants are knocked out of the market, so it's a vicious circle. Secondly, technological risk. Electricity generation technologies are rapidly changing. Any point in time, technological change may well reduce the real long-run marginal cost by 20 to 50%, especially with the massive amount of research effort going in at the current time around the world. Few are going to build a $2 billion plant today that could become obsolete shortly after it becomes operational. Three, regulatory risk. If $60 to $80 a tonne CO2 price results in excessive economic damage, it will simply be lowered. Without compensation guarantee of future prices, fewer risk large investment funds. And four, gas supply risk. Yes, generators can supply long-term contracts for gas supply. However, at any time, new gas discoveries could result in suppliers willing to supply long-term gas at a fraction of current prices, especially if the location were remote from existing gas distribution infrastructure or global LNG market was oversupplied. One option a corporate estate would readily implement would be to combine all the generations into a single body. The arithmetic is simple. Under the present structure of independent suppliers, a $55 a tonne carbon price result in cost per megawatt hour increasing from $45 to $50 to around $90, or an increase in the wholesale price of 80%. If these costs could be spread over the entire capacity, as would be the case under a single entity, then the wholesale price increase would be limited to 20%, or about 7% of the price increase at the retail level, which would represent a minor irritant. However, there would be further cost short-term savings. The price increases would be phased in as plans are completed. In terms of cost savings, if the strict neoliberal approach to the current Australian situation were followed without any market intervention, a cumulative CO2 price cost would be imposed on generators of between $110 billion to $150 billion, allowing for market instability and risk margins, with no guarantee anything would happen. The corporate estate would allow a guaranteed outcome for total cumulative electricity cost increases between now and 2020 being restricted to between $15 and $20 billion, or about 15 to 20% of the neoliberal approach. All other risks would be reduced to zero by allowing a monopoly. It is this logic that explains why the electricity sector was nationalised in Australia in the first half of the 20th century. As state after state gave up trying to induce the required supply response at the right price from an albeit regulated private electricity sector. A good corporate estate that didn't want to renationalise the generating industry in Australia would sit down with the generators and hammer out an agreement for ownership change, exit arrangements on reasonable terms, and a regulatory environment that delivered an outcome in line with the old nationalised model, where the private sector still had a role to play. The current Queensland model for encouraging the use of gas and electricity generation would be a good place to start. The ultimate model would probably resemble this model and the model used by Victoria to run its train system. The Garnaut recommendation to ignore private sector losses is not the right way to go. Governments are going to have to rely on the private sector, albeit with substantial risk shifting to the public sector, to undertake a substantial proportion of the hundreds of billions of dollars needed for greenhouse gas reduction. Any rational corporate estate approach to CO2 reduction would place the emissions trading system at the end point, not at the beginning of the policy design. It would work out all possible regulatory, technology and mandatory market incentives, with the carbon price then set in terms of financing requirements and long-term strategic direction. A corporate estate would laugh off the suggestions of the neoliberals that Australia needs a higher CO2 price for energy efficiency. Yes, there is some low-lying fruit, but this isn't the main game. Australia makes little equipment, so energy efficiency gains will depend on how overseas suppliers respond to the world carbon price. Accelerated depreciation allowances, tight investment allowances, and energy-efficient performance regulation would be far more efficient in encouraging speedy adjustment. High carbon prices by themselves would simply result, in many cases, in plant shutdowns when they reach the end of their commercial life. By plant shutdowns, we mean manufacturing and things general. If the Treasury modelling into carbon prices simply assumes that the market operates optimally and with near perfect substitution of factors of production, which is common in computerised general equilibrium modelling, then it should be immediately thrown into the bin for the rubbish it will be. In this context, one of the best things the Federal Parliament could do for climate change is to give back to the states their income tax base set in terms of their responsibilities so they can build the necessary transport infrastructure and urban design to minimise the CO2 content of connectiveness. The situation is now reaching the extreme position where an increasing number of households in major metropolitan areas will not have the time and or financial incomes to reach their place of work on a regular basis. To do this, the Federal Parliament needs to stop the practice of spending what should be state resources on income tax cuts to enhance its short-term election prospects. Finally, in relation to climate change, if the implication of a figure which I have put in the text, which is from the book just published called Climate Code Red, is correct, then it is very likely that by 2012, the IPCC may well revise up its sea level rise projections by 2100 to 10 or more metres, in the same way that predictions of an ice-free summer Arctic have been quickly brought forward from 100 years' time to the near term. I think the latest is 2013. And things haven't been going well recently up there. That is, the 2 to 4 degrees centigrade predicted rise in global temperatures, even with substantial emission reduction success, would still result in tens of metres rise in sea level. This would require a response to reduce CO2 in the atmosphere back to the 1990 level of 350 parts per million, which would in turn require a near zero emissions target by 2050. This would necessitate drastic action, but the tools of the corporate estate could could enable it to be done, albeit with no increase in living standards, that is, consumption per capita, for decades. National security. In the 2001 lecture, I gently suggested that to protect the national interest and economic sovereignty, it would be desirable to bring foreign investment decisions back under parliamentary control and scrutiny, and not to leave it to an effectively unaccountable body. This has become more urgent. There is no national interest in allowing major customers, that is Chinese enterprises, to control Australian resources. The objective here is simply to transfer value from Australia to China to enhance international competitiveness and real incomes. The concept of sending tax inspectors to Beijing over the next 10 to 20 years, if of course they manage to get a good hold of the resource base here, to politely ask to see the books of what will be by then the biggest corp companies in the world, owned by a potentially hostile country, to try and recoup billions of lost tax revenue is laughable. The only possible reason to allow China or any other major customer to buy Australian resource assets would be if the supply of resources at prices that would prevail if Australia was an occupied colony was in fact as part of our defence policy. If indeed it is part of our defence policy, it is not likely to work. The thing about global powers is that the stronger they get, the more they want realised projections of that power to feel secure. In the not too distant future, no doubt, China will establish bases in Timor or nearby to secure, quote unquote, their trade routes. China will have the economic resources to buy many countries. If they secure these bases and Chinese enterprises own substantial Australian resource assets, then it would be a simple matter to organise the blowing up of an offshore oil rig, which they would own, and then deploy naval units to the northwest coast on the grounds it was necessary to protect their assets, which Australia was no longer able to do. Once there, the region would be effectively annexed, using the same tactics that Western European powers used to effectively annex Chinese and Japanese key trading ports, along with control of their national commercial policies in the 19th century. A good case can be made that if things don't change and a large-scale investment does result, then Australia is heading towards a classic banana republic status. The phrase banana republic was invented to describe a country like Honduras, where foreign interests, that is the United States, control that region of that country, producing the principal export bananas and all supporting infrastructure. The region was run like a private fiefdom in which companies kept order and crushed labour dissent by the use of their own security forces and, when necessary, by calling United States troops who then established military bases. The irony is that it was the aim of preventing Australia from becoming a banana republic, a la Paul Keating's 1986 statement, there's one reason for adopting the extreme neoliberal model. It wouldn't be the first time that a policy shift achieved the reverse of what was intended. In this context, for Parliament not to take back control of foreign investment decisions could well be seen from the hindsight of 2030 as pure treason. When doing this, the Parliament could usefully abolish the Productivity Commission and replace it with a body directly under parliamentary control focused on protecting Australia's economic and political sovereignty. The Productivity Commission can do good work, but unfortunately, its neoliberal ideological blinkers can result in unintentionally operating as a fifth column within government, reinforcing those private and foreign messages and demands that will undermine the national interests. This is an intolerable situation. Whether or not the above occurs depends very much on the speed of relative decline of the United States relative to China. Over the next decade, Australian security very much depends on the relative decline in political economic strength. Over the next decades, the Australian security very much depends on the relative decline in political economy strength of the United States being as slow as possible, so as to allow the region to develop balanced, multipolar, counterweight power centres in which Australia can enhance its security. Unfortunately, trends in this regard are not optimistic. The United States has seemed to have gotten itself into an unstable political cycle where the Republicans are hell-bent on exhausting the federal treasury, largely for the benefit of their own constituency, so that when the other side obtains office, there are little resources available to correct some of the US's fundamental problems, which are not too dissimilar to Australia's, except absorb the odium of rising taxes, ensuring the political cycle will continue. This, when coupled with established interests being able to influence both parties, that's in the US, for change regulation, removal of regulation, and less regulatory oversight for the enormous benefit of few and the eventual misery of many, does not bode well for our political response that will arrest US's decline. In this context, it's not surprising that the outcome during the Bush administration was that 75% of the economic gains went to the top 1% of taxpayers. To sustain its economic strength and combat climate change, the United States, like Australia, requires a redistribution of resources from consumption to investment. The magnitude of such a change probably can only be done with very strong political leadership that, in relatively normal times, could only effectively come from the leader from the right, that is, a Republican such as Teddy Roosevelt did in the early part of last century in terms of reform. This avoids the charge of class warfare. For a Democratic leader to engineer this outcome, it would require a massive economic and security crisis as per Franklin Roosevelt. This might, of course, occur. But the probability is that the United States will continue to experience destabilising political cycles that will sap its economic and political strength. The point may well be reached sooner than any of us think, when the United States have to decide, as Britain did in 1902 with the Anglo-Japanese Treaty, of what were its strategic interests and what it had to let go. That is, the United States may well have to decide what is in its formal sphere of interest and what will have to concede to China, India, etc. The greater Australia becomes vital to the Chinese economy and the greater Chinese investment in Australia, the more likely, irrespective of history, culture and tradition, that the United States may have to decide that Australia no longer can be justified as being a member of its sphere of influence. From this perspective, the faster Australia can diversify its trade and the stake of countries in Australia, the greater the ability Australia will have to protect its effective sovereignty. This gives industry policy a strategic security status, which is in common with most other corporate estates. There's a bit on industry policy, but I'll skip. Just means it's been a disaster and we better do a lot better. You can read it in the text. The conclusion. The outlook for the next 20 years realistically has to be approached with a sense of pessimism. Left unabated, current trends suggest Australia will be facing increasing external pressure coupled with internal economic malaise, with a growing feeling that political institutions are no longer working. The most recent period that is likely to be similar to in the past was the mid-1970s, which arose from a combination of intense Cold War pressure and economic meltdown associated with the oil price shocks. The mid-1970s was a strange time, with coups, quasi-coups and attempted coups in a number of countries, including the United Kingdom, where the early stages of an attempted coup centred on Lord Mountbatten was terminated by the resignation of the British Prime Minister of the day, Harold Wilson. To avoid similar circumstances prevailing, Parliament's role is clear. It must be seen to be effective in putting in place institutions and policies which will govern the market in a way that the current and future challenges are controlled, stemmed and defeated. The consequences of failure to do this are unthinkable, in that it will resemble and perhaps in some ways be more intense than the political and economic pressure applied to Australia between 1931 and 1942. More intensive, in that a large percentage of the population could have a very poor long-term expectation of the future. And this time around, Australia could be without powerful friends which it had a natural affinity with. To effectively combat the three challenges of climate change, external security and internal stability, the requirement is for adoption and maintenance of a semi-war footing in policy focus and implementation. That's it.
We have some time for some questions. Could I ask any questioners to go to the microphones on either side of the... If that doesn't provoke some questions, I don't know what will. Yes.
Dr. Brain, I just wonder if you might care to comment on Australia's seemingly ever burgeoning foreign debt levels over the past decade or so. I understand that foreign debt isn't really a problem so long as you can service the debt. Do you think there's any likelihood, or what sort of likelihood do you think there might be of Australia getting into problems with servicing that debt?
Well, firstly, I thought my last part of my speech was about who owns the debt could be quite important to Australia's future security. In terms of the foreign debt, what you're probably alluding to is the fact that although we had an enormous mining boom and returns of trade escalation, the current account deficit hasn't improved. And that is because the mining sector is now about 75% foreign owned. So that for every dollar, and it's got very little operating costs, I mean, relative to other industries. So for every dollar we get from a price increase, probably over 50% flows back into the current account deficit and foreign debt, if you like, because it accrues as profits to foreign enterprises. Now, to some extent, that's been disguised by the fact that some of those profits that have been credited to foreign enterprises is, of course, re-spent in Australia to expand the mining sector. So the current account deficit has gone up has offset the terms of trade rise, and we've got, the benefit of the investment. I suppose the real problem comes when that all stops and terms of trade track back down again, and we no longer get the capacity expansion, I suppose, then the full extent of the case can be seen in terms of the difficulties. So it's been largely neutral. The fact of the matter is that the impact of the current account deficit hasn't improved because as terms of trades have gone up, the income's flowed out, and secondly, they've invested here, which has required the importation of more capital, which has entailed more foreign borrowing, which more interests are being credited to the overseas lenders. So we've been in a neutral situation. Well, despite the almighty terms of trade boom, nothing's happened. The consequences are when it stops, the music stops. Does that answer your question or not really?
I don't know if I fully absorb your answer, to be quite frank. But
oh, well, the other thing I suppose you're talking about, yes, we have one of the highest current account debts in the world. So, and we've seen from a number of countries recently, such as Iceland, which had similar high current account deficits and debt, their exchange rates plunged. So Australia is obviously vulnerable to the current world slowdown if oil and coal prices turn back down again sharply, then the Australian currency will plunge. Interest rates, inflation will go up. We've still got 4.5, it'll probably go up to 6 or 7. And then interest rates have to go through the roof, and then we'll be in almost a depression type situation. That's the risk. That answer your question?
Pretty well, but just a final comment that when Prime Minister Howard came to office, our foreign debt was about 29%, I think, of GDP.
Yeah.
And the sky was about to fall in. It was 55 or 60% now, I think, currently.
Yes. Well, the other figure I meant to put in my talk, but I didn't, was the fact that foreign ownership of Australian corporate income now is over. This in 2008-09, we're over 50%. I think that really puts us probably in banana republic status.
Yes, another question.
We're told that the market is the best regulator of the economy. But yet we have the situation where we have Enron, we had our homegrown HIH, now we have Freddie Mac and Freddie Mae in the United States. And we read that there was legislation in place to actually prevent disasters such as this occurring, disasters which are now affecting us all. We are told that the market, this supreme being, obviously has no morals, no ethics, no scruples, and no memory, which is a bit of a worry, but action in terms of failure is always retrospective, and it is so geared that it is never going to lose because it always has its hands in the taxpayer's pocket, and its ability to actually convert us back into serfs, as you mentioned already. Would you like to comment, please? Thank you.
Oh, well, yes, that's... I did one of the points about it all comes back to excessive monetary growth. As soon as you have excessive monetary growth in relation to basic requirements for real sector stability, you get the things I've talked about over
buying of households for consumption, you know, drift, house prices going up, drift into surf status, but also financial shenanigans that drive up the value of financial assets, illusionary. So people think that they're wealthy or not, financial engineering, so it all comes to the end, like just like any Ponzi scheme. So really, what you're talking about is when you get too much excessive monetary growth, you get all the things mentioned, plus what you mentioned of financial engineering, which undermines financial institutions, and that was behind my quote, for the benefit of a few and the misery of many. It's just another, reason for keeping very tight monetary control.
Any other questions?
Excuse me, does that mean we should never have floated the dollar?
No, it just means that we should have put in a monetary regime that was more appropriate, more defined, and more in terms of European standards. The monetary policy regime that we put in really was a benefit short-term political interest because it was non-capped, so to speak, no cap on the credit that was floating around. It created periods of intense aspirational euphoria, which politicians always like because it means they get re-elected.
Bigger houses.
Bigger houses.
Last question.
Mr. Speaker.
A brief question.
Yes, it is a brief question. You raised the question of returning to history. And all my notes that I'm taking cover history. China, Russia, a man died just the other day, 2 days ago. I was coming along expecting that we might have heard about the Gulag. What a dreadful thing. You then start to talk about English history that ran slavery up to 18. All I'm saying to myself, do you mean to say that we haven't learnt to start with history first and try to allow the politicians? I'm wondering when we're going to have one talk here, this is all my question, on history. Everything that I get, either on the Telstra Effort History Channel or I find the English magazines, they are saying, when was the worst period in history? Until we put history as you, everybody here speaks from themselves, we won't even start to look at the alternative. And now my question is, should we start and look at the alternatives?
Well, I agree 100%. I mean, what strikes me, especially about Australia, is we all start at year zero. Year zero is now. I mean, that's what I was talking about, the approach to emissions trading and carbon price. We're starting from year zero as if we didn't learn anything over the past 100 years. The capacity of Australia to do that is just simply amazing. The capacity of other countries, such as the Europeans and obviously the North Asians, is that history is so vital to understanding where they're going forward. I'm very pessimistic, unless we start doing what you're saying, I think, then we won't deserve to survive as a nation. A nation that starts everything at year zero in terms of its intellectual capital, it's not a very good way to go about things.
Well, unless some questioner can inject a note of optimism into the discussion, I think we'll call a halt on that note. Please join me in thanking our lecturer.